This is a takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris Perry. In the earliest days of the COVID-19 pandemic, when health risks and isolation protocol felt ever-changing, there was one nightly routine New Yorkers could rely on. The shouts of New York residents cheering for essential workers. The nurses, healthcare professionals, or grocery store employees who risk their own health to keep critical operations running for everybody else. The banging of pots and pans, the applause. It was the sound of recognition for a labor force often overlooked. And the deathly circumstances that essential workers faced on a daily basis reimagined the ways that we view the conditions of labor itself. Jamie McCallum, professor of sociology at Middlebury College, unpacks the pandemic's effect on labor rights in his new book.
Essential: How the Pandemic Transformed the Long Fight for Worker Justice. In short, the pandemic revealed the extent to which our lives are intertwined with their jobs. Essential workers jeopardized their own health, safety, and security for the greater good. Yet the pernicious conditions they worked under and the obstacles they faced to improving their jobs undermined not only their personal health, but also our collective well-being. By shortchanging essential workers, we performed the collective Ouroboros, the ancient symbol of a snake devouring its own tail.
I spoke with Jamie about the intersection of labor and racial justice movements, rising inflation, and policy surrounding workers' rights. And I wanted to understand, how does the recent pandemic-era labor movement compare to worker justice movements that we've seen in our past?
Basically, I think the pandemic had an important and transformative effect on the way average working class folks work and organize. So during the pandemic, this frontline class emerged of essential workers from the ranks of the old working class, who are usually siloed in their industries and occupations. But this time, in 2020, workplace organizing and social justice struggles outside the workplace began to cross-pollinate each other. So half of the mass strikes in 2020 were led by nurses, but their picket lines, for example, attracted all kinds of other essential workers. And from doctors to delivery drivers to retail clerks, et cetera. And I met these people when they were out on strike. And then you had social justice movements like Black Lives Matter talking about the strike for Black lives, like using the language and tactics of labor to talk about racial justice. So it was a pretty interesting time for when these two worlds came together in a way they typically don't. The other thing that I think was really important was that workers really took matters into their own hands. If you're used to hearing about traditional labor organizing before the pandemic, it was the case that, you know, large unions largely drove the campaigns. And in 2020, workers, even those without unions, began to take action. And I think it's this, you know, walking out, sicking out, slowing down, going on strike, even without support of their unions. I think this bottom-up approach that we now see taking hold most visibly in places like the Amazon campaigns and the Starbucks union campaigns.
I want to zero in a bit on this intersection between workers' justice and racial justice, because I hear you. On the one hand, we think of those as perhaps kind of cousin movements, but not necessarily happening together. And yet A. Philip Randolph, was one of the organizers of the March on Washington. In fact, you know, made the initial call for it. And, you know, Randolph was, of course, as much a labor organizer as a race organizer. And the, you know, again, that 1963 march was the March on Washington for Jobs and Justice. I wonder if it's how we tell the story of our labor movement, or if it is genuinely that our labor movements have been in certain ways separated from our racial justice movements.
Yeah, this is a really critical point. I think that, so labor historians often look back and recognize that the sort of labor officialdom of the 20th century missed a historic opportunity to really organize alongside the Black Freedom Movement and the Civil Rights Movement. And during the pandemic, I think something interesting happened, because the essential working class was so Black and brown. it was disproportionately workers of color and women who were in essential jobs. And their industries that were most impacted were really diverse occupations. And so racial justice concerns and concerns about workplace safety and wages and healthcare, et cetera, all became coterminous and really began to influence each other. And so I think it was a really important time where those issues, to some extent, were brought together. And some of the leaders of those pandemic labor movements, like Chris Malls, for example, from the Amazon warehouse in Staten Island, was also a leader within Black Lives Matter. So there was a lot of way those two things came together.
Let's talk a little bit about these essential frontline workers. Again, folks who, maybe hadn't ever even used that language to talk about themselves or had been spoken about by either their employers or by the larger economy in that way. Who are we talking about here?
So the term essential workers, you know, refers to people who are critical to our health and safety. But what was really interesting early on in 2020 is that what actually defined essential workers sometimes was quite capricious. Like, employers really fought to have themselves designated as essential, even when it was clear that there was no obvious reason why they should be. And so we get sort of a hodgepodge of people who are clearly necessary, like healthcare workers and education workers and logistics people and retail clerks and grocery store workers. You know, I also interviewed people who worked at beauty salons and who were greeters at Walmart and who worked at convenience stores that didn't sell any essential items. And they were clearly put in harm's way for no obvious reason. So I think the sort of a classification of what an essential worker was or is was oftentimes a big point of discussion or struggle for workers themselves, because those who were clearly designated as essential workers could sort of use that status as a badge of honor, as power, when they went about fighting for better conditions on the job. And those that didn't have that status had less ability to do so.
It's early on in the first chapter when you talk about, or you first introduce this idea of Walmart greeters, right? So not the folks who were actually staffing the or supplying the shelves at Walmart. I think we really do understand why they would constitute essential workers at a time, again, initially just trying to get enough toilet paper and paper towels and soap in our homes. But why would, help me to understand from a business perspective, why would it be in Walmart's interest as an employer to have its greeters designated as essential workers?
I don't think it is in their interest. I mean, I think they made a mistake. Like, some of those workers died as a result. I mean, I met family members of Walmart greeters who died and who caused, you know, massive outpourings of public resentment and frustration toward the company. I think they thought that keeping business as usual and their ordinary sort of cultural landscape of the way they operate was really critical. But I think that was ultimately a poor calculation. And I think, you know, as the pandemic waxed and waned and changed, different businesses made different calculations as to what kinds of workers they needed to bring back or to leave off. And I think that decision early on by a lot of companies to sort of, you know, bring as many people as they could was a poor calculation.
You write pretty clearly here, the real antidote to the deadly failings of capitalism is socialism. And to get there, workers will need to create a crisis for capital. In what ways did the pandemic allow workers the capacity to create that crisis for capital?
You know, as a scholar or as a labor activist, when I think about labor's future, I obviously look ahead. But as a scholar, I look back in history. And it's pretty clear that the times when workers have been most successful at getting what they want, for fighting for what they want, is when they were most unruly, when they stepped out of the boundaries of typical, relatively orderly, organized labor activism and created a kind of crisis. In other words, a moment where corporate America had to really decide. And I think the Striketober in the fall of 2021, where a wave of strikes in so many different industries just kept happening in the middle of a historic labor shortage, was a time when workers really sort of seized the moment of opportunity and stepped through that window and said, we're going to go on the offensive. And some of those strikes had the outcome of winning wage increases and health and safety increases and winning people's jobs back and these other things that really, you know, made a pretty big difference at a time when the pandemic was still raging. So I think that there were moments when those things did happen. In the end, I would say that those moments when workers create a crisis large enough to really win deep transformation are rare. And it didn't happen during the pandemic, right? It hasn't happened. It may still happen, but unions and organized labor will really have to seize that opportunity in a way, create that opportunity that they haven't done yet.
So walk me through this a bit. I mean, for years, I reported on the fight for 15 and the ways that low-wage workers were really pushing for the point at which it starts to actually sort of move. I mean, 15 is hardly even a living wage, but it becomes some sort of basic floor. And then it felt as though the pandemic, through the creation of a labor shortage, right, in part through the health crisis, but also because of the crisis of childcare that pushed women out of the workforce and all of that, creates a tight labor market. And suddenly this thing that workers had been pushing for so long starts to come to the fore. We see wages increase. Help me to understand, is that a result of labor organizing, either before or during the pandemic? Or is that just the invisible hand of the market, tight labor market, lower wages go up?
So that's a great question. And it's a great way to historicize it. The fight for 15, when it first began, like people thought that those workers were out of their minds. They thought, oh, they want to double the minimum wage in a low wage industry like fast food. Like, that's crazy. And yet they did it. And state after state, place after place, employers began raising the wage. And now, as you said, even $15 is in many places almost a poverty wage. And really, we should be thinking about the fight for 25, the fight for 30 these days. However, I think that, you know, the thing about market forces or these kinds of things, you know, driving up standards and conditions, there was some of that. I mean, in the fallout from the economic catastrophe in 2020, the CARES Act and then the American Rescue Plan did a lot to actually put money into people's pockets. And that really matters. And as you know, as we've studied, we now know that poverty declined pretty significantly over the last few years. And workers still have some pandemic unemployment money and pandemic funds sloshing around in their bank accounts. I think the thing to be really cognizant of, though, is that those things can go away at the drop of a hat. Like, inflation rises and falls, market forces ebb and flow, and with it, workers' fortunes. And so I think there was a lot of activity that really created the conditions for a tight labor market that were really subjective, that really reflected workers' agency, either by choosing to stay home when it was important to stay home, or by just striking or protest or walking out or whatever it was to create those kinds of little mini crises here and there. It's, you know, real that we can attribute some of those good fortunes that workers to some extent have right now to that kind of activism activity.
And then the thing that all conservatives have been telling me for years would happen happened. Inflation increased. And for years, I'd had progressive economists say, no, 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 when wages go up, it won't have that kind of effect. Here we are facing an election where the question of inflation is over and over again the top issue for voters. And I'm wondering, were progressives telling me something wrong that whole time? Or is something else is there a different way to understand what's happening with our economy on the other side of these increased wages?
So there's important research done by economists. I am not an economist, but you know, there's important research done by economists that show that there's, you know, a certain degree or percentage of inflationary pressure that is the result of companies simply holding us hostage, that is simply holding back supplies to drive up prices. And I think that pandemic profiteering was a real problem, despite the CARES Act and the ARP after it giving us some really good social protections. We increased our number of billionaires, and we increased the billions that other billionaires already had. And I think that what we're seeing now, the inflationary pressures we're seeing now, are to some extent an extension of that general sort of profiteering process that really that began in earnest in 2020.
What do you see as the current agenda for labor, particularly as we move to the other side of the 2022 midterms, which means basically by the end of the week, we'll be into the 2024 presidential election cycle. What do you see as the political agenda, the economic agenda of this broad, diverse, intersectional labor movement?
Yes, that is the question on everyone's mind. So it's great to talk about. I think there's a few things. One, I think that labor really has to celebrate its victories and what it did during the pandemic. And I think sometimes it has been unable to capture the public's imagination with some of that. And that really is that, you know, like unions saved lives during the pandemic. And I mean that in the sense that, you know, for example, I did research with other co-authors that showed that unionized nursing homes had a much lower percentage of deaths among residents and lower levels of infection among workers for COVID during the pandemic compared to non-union homes. So, and in schools, unions helped pressure to win mask mandates where even conservative governments didn't institute them. And we know those were really serious ways to contain the virus. So I think that, you know, unions have to some extent, they need a public relations facelift and to really make it clear what kinds of things people did during the pandemic. And I think that doing so will help them build toward certain signature policy goals that they want. And the most important one that we should all hope to God we get soon is the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or the PRO Act. So the PRO Act it passed a vote in the House last year and is awaiting a vote going forward. It would basically amend our current labor law to create a fairer playing field when workers organize unions. Union elections are up 60% in 2021. That's crazy, an incredible high explosion of interest in people wanting to join unions. And yet managements across the country are fighting them tooth and nail. And so we need the PRO Act to limit management interference so that workers can get what they want. The general public, who also supports unions at record high rates, also gets what they want. And I think that politically, that will be one sort of short-term goal that labor should push for.
Are you feeling optimistic about this next phase?
It's hard for people who study the labor world to feel optimistic that often, because the deck really is stacked pretty hard against workers. I think when I think about this question, you know, you have to know where to look. The thing that most people, I think, forget is that unions and labor activity doesn't happen because people are upset or resentful or frustrated sometimes, but mostly it happens because they hope, they have optimism that taking these large risks of walking out of your job and forming a union, et cetera, is worth it. And it will make a big difference. And hundreds of thousands of people made that choice during some of the worst years of our lives with incredible risks to themselves. And I think it's that kind of heroism, not just the heroism of going to your job every day, but of standing up and trying to make your job better, that, you know, which has ripple effects for all of us. I think that kind of work gives me some optimism, and it gives me some sort of a leg to stand on and say, people did not abandon this cause, even in their darkest days. And whatever happens after the midterms, labor will have to fight. And there's a lot of people in the labor movement right now who have been really like preparing for that fight in over the last few years. And I have some degree of optimism and hope that they're well positioned for a long and tough battle.
I want to make one more request of you. One of the things we often like to do when we're producing segments that are emerging from a book is to have the author read just a small portion of it, either the PDF or the physical book in front of you. It's just a very short paragraph from the introduction that I was going to ask you to read.
There's so much to say about it, but I'll read this now. In short, the pandemic revealed the extent to which our lives are intertwined with their jobs. Essential workers jeopardize their own health, safety, and security for the greater good. Yet the pernicious conditions they worked under and the obstacles they faced to improving their jobs undermined not only their personal health, but also our collective well-being. By shortchanging essential workers, we performed the collective Ouroboros, the ancient symbol of a snake devouring its own tail.
Thank you so much for that. Is there anything final that I've missed that you would want to be sure we touch on in this conversation?
I guess the only thing I would say that is interesting is really to that point that I find really important is I'll just say that I think the pandemic illuminated why we should all care about bad labor conditions and worker rights, even if we don't hold those jobs ourselves. Because, you know, an economy like ours that's filled with bad jobs is a huge liability. And low pay for nursing home workers meant that, you know, workers had to work two jobs and they spread the virus from place to place as they went. And delivery drivers working long hours were more prone to deadly accidents. And the flip side is also true, that when workers have a voice, we all do better. Union workers in essential industries had more access to PPE and other equipment that helped make those workplaces safer for everyone. So basically, their working conditions are our living conditions. And I think the pandemic drove home that point in a really important way.
Jamie McCallum is author of Essential, How the Pandemic Transformed the Long Fight for Worker Justice. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.